Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org. Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
You know, usually when we talk about a spiritual path or a religious doctrine, there is this almost unquestioned expectation of a very clean, structured progression.
Oh, absolutely. We always think of it like a ladder.
Right, exactly like a ladder. You start at the very bottom, you follow the rules, and you accumulate good deeds.
And you avoid the bad ones, hopefully.
Yeah, and slowly, rung by rung, you climb your way up toward enlightenment or salvation. The instructions are clear.
And the hierarchy is deeply respected. We defer to the elders who have been climbing that ladder for decades.
Because it is deeply comforting to our conventional minds to view spirituality that way, we naturally crave linearity.
We do. We like our progress to be measurable, you know, to be categorized into distinct stages.
And most importantly, we want it to be logical.
Exactly. If I do A and B, I will eventually achieve C. That transactional mindset is, well, it's the bedrock of almost every human endeavor.
Even surprisingly, how we approach the end of suffering.
Yes. But then you step into the world of the profound Mahayana teachings.
And that is exactly what we are exploring in this Dharma teaching today. You open up this specific text and suddenly that comforting ladder is not just broken.
No, it is revealed to be an absolute illusion.
The rungs are gone, the climber is a mirage, and the destination is nowhere to be found.
We find ourselves looking at a spiritual landscape that is profoundly, deliberately, and beautifully disruptive.
So today we are dismantling that ladder. We are stepping into the ancient city of Vaishuli, where a three-year-old toddler is about to completely silence the most enlightened, revered monks on earth.
It is such a wild premise. We are looking at a scholarly lecture on the sutra titled Teaching the Practice of a Bodhi Suicitiva,
translated by the magnificent 84,000 Project.
Right, and this is such a vital text to unpack. In the Tibetan canon, this is To 184. Our mission in our exploration of the sutra today is to walk with you through this remarkable translation.
We want to pull apart its radical teachings on emptiness and what it calls non-apprehending.
And we really need to define its key terms, not just academically, but functionally.
Yeah, we want to discover together how this ancient wisdom fundamentally shifts our modern understanding of what a spiritual practice even is.
But to properly frame this exploration, we have to recognize the historical gravity of what we are reading. This text holds immense weight.
It really does. It was translated into Tibetan during a golden age of translation, right?
Yes, in the late 8th to early 9th century. Esteemed Indian preceptors like Jina Mitra and Prajyavarman worked on it.
And it was even cited by the great Indian philosopher Nagarjuna, so it is foundational.
Completely foundational. But what makes this text so utterly captivating, what keeps you turning the pages, is its narrative hook.
Because it centers on a startling inversion of everything you expect from a religious text. We are not just listening to the Buddha give a sermon from a throne to a quiet, compliant audience.
Not at all. The core premise involves a toddler.
A three-year-old boy named Ratnadatta, and this child boldly critiques, debates, and systematically schools the most senior esteemed elders of the Buddha's assembly.
Specifically venerable figures like Moggallana and Sariputra. He instructs them on the true nature of reality.
Which is mind-blowing. By placing the ultimate truth in the mouth of a toddler, the sutra immediately signals to you, the listener, that you must abandon your conventional reliance on status.
Right. Status, age, external markers of wisdom. The sutra is demanding that you listen to the substance of the truth, regardless of the vessel it pours from.
So let's transport ourselves. We need to set the scene to understand the sheer scale of what is about to happen. We are in the ancient, bustling, wealthy city of Vaishali.
And just outside this city is the Kyugarashila,
which was a highly significant monastery located in the forest outside the city walls.
Yeah, its name actually translates to hall with an upper chamber. This is a place of deep retreat, a hub of profound instruction.
And the text tells us that the Blessed One, the Buddha Shakyamuni, is dwelling there, but he is not resting there alone.
No, the assembly surrounding him is staggering.
The text goes into incredible detail about his retinue. It describes an assembly of 1,000 monks.
And it makes sure we know these are not novices who are just learning to meditate.
Right. It explicitly states they are worthy ones whose defilements were exhausted. They were without afflictions and completely in control.
Their minds were perfectly free, and their insight was perfectly liberated. They are described majestically as great elephants who have finally laid down their heavy burdens.
Which means they are the Arhats. They represent the absolute pinnacle of the foundational path.
Exactly. They have achieved personal liberation from the cycle of birth and death. They have conquered their own suffering.
But the text doesn't stop there. Alongside these 1,000 Arhats, it places 1,000 Bodhisattvas.
And the description of their qualities sets the philosophical stakes for everything that follows. The sutra says they have attained the stage free from regression.
They possess the patience of equanimity. And crucially, it notes they have relinquished arising and disintegration.
And possess the meditative absorption on signlessness.
I really want to pause on that phrase, relinquished arising and disintegration. Because to a modern ear, that sounds like a physics equation, not a spiritual state.
It does sound a bit clinical at first.
Right. What does it mean to relinquish arising and disintegration?
Well, it is the core of the Mahayana realization of emptiness. Normally, you and I look at the world and we see things being born, existing for a while, and then dying.
Right. A tree sprouts, grows, and rots. The thought arises, stays in the mind, and fades.
Exactly. We deeply believe in the inherent reality of creation and destruction. So to relinquish arising and disintegration means you have directly perceived that at the ultimate level, nothing has inherent independent existence.
Because nothing exists independently, nothing can truly be said to arise out of nowhere.
And nothing can truly disintegrate into nothingness. Everything is a fluid, interdependent display. These bodhisattvas rest in that understanding constantly.
Wow. So we have this gathering of absolute spiritual titans. You have figures like Maitreya, Manjushir, Avalokiteshvara, and hundreds of others whose very names signify immense realization.
One morning, this unimaginable assembly moves. The Buddha dons his robes, takes up his alms bowl, and accompanied by 2,000 of these fully realized beings, begins the walk.
They walk from the forest monastery toward the city gates of Vaishali to collect alms.
Which on the surface is a completely mundane daily routine for a monastic community. The begging of alms is an act of humility for the monks.
And a way to allow the lay community to practice generosity, it happens every day.
But on this particular morning, the mundane is about to become cosmic.
When the Buddha reaches the city limits, it is not just a quiet arrival. The moment he places his foot on the threshold of the city gates, the environment literally fractures and blooms.
The physical world responds in a way that is almost overwhelming to visualize.
The text says, blind people gain sight, deaf people gain hearing, and the insane regain their senses.
A rain of divine flowers fell, a bright light shone, and the roads became free of filth.
And it continues. The enchanting musical instruments of the gods resound even without being played by human hands.
And perhaps most astonishingly, it says, all beings from the hell of uninterrupted torment up to the highest heaven became completely happy.
Let's really look at this because it is so easy for us reading ancient texts with modern skeptical minds to just gloss over these miracles as, you know, mythological window dressing.
Oh, for sure. We might think, oh, this is just a bit of magical realism the authors threw in to make the founder look impressive.
Exactly. But why does the sutra actually open this way? What is the function of this world-bending display?
It is a critical question. And honestly, it is the key to understanding the entire text. In this framework, these are not mere magical flourishes meant to entertain a crowd.
They serve a profound ontological purpose.
Yes. They establish the presence of a fully awakened being as an event that literally restructures reality and restructures karma.
Right, because if we think about the underlying physics of this worldview, mind and matter aren't completely separate domains the way we often treat them in the West.
Exactly, they aren't separate. The Buddha's complete realization of emptiness, his total lack of self-grasping, means that his physical presence is no longer hindered by the normal, rigid laws of cause and effect.
The laws that bind ordinary beings.
Right. Think of it like a video game where the characters are bound by the physics engine gravity, solid walls, linear time.
And the Buddha is someone who has realized that the code itself is empty.
Yes. Because his mind is completely unbound, his physical environment responds to his infinite, unconditioned compassion.
So it's like a localized glitch in the matrix of suffering.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it.
When his foot touches the threshold, his immense accumulated merit and compassion spontaneously overwrite the local physics.
The alleviation of suffering, the blind suddenly seeing, the beings in the hell of uninterrupted torment suddenly experiencing complete happiness, is not him casting a magic spell.
It is the spontaneous, effortless manifestation of his awakened state interacting with the world.
Exactly. And it sets the stage for the rest of the teaching. By showing us a physical restructuring of the world, the sutra is softening our minds.
It is preparing us for the radical philosophical restructuring that the child Ratnadatta will soon deliver.
The logic of the text is incredibly clear. If the physical laws of blindness and gravity can be suspended by awakening, so too can our rigid conceptual laws of what is right and wrong.
What is spiritual and what is worldly? And these world-bending miracles do not go unnoticed by the city's inhabitants. They draw the attention of a specific resident of Vaishali.
Which brings us to our protagonist, a Lachavi toddler, just 3 years old, sitting on his mother's lap on the top floor of their house.
His name is Ratnadatta.
The Lachavi were a highly prominent, wealthy Republican clan in ancient India. They basically governed Vaishali.
So Ratnadatta, being from this patrician family, would have been surrounded by relative comfort, high social standing, and fine things.
Yet, as he sits by the window, he is completely captivated, not by his toys or his wealth, but by the cosmic shift happening outside.
Ratnadatta sees this brilliant light drying up the dampness of the lower realms, and he sees these unseasonable divine flowers falling from the sky.
And he turns to his mother and asks a very lucid question for a three-year-old.
He says, "Whose magical power has manifested these extraordinary miracles? This light outshines the radiance of millions of suns."
And this leads to one of the most beautiful sections of the text. The mother's response is not a simple, "Oh, that is the Buddha, dear."
No, she replies in a series of stunning, deeply poetic verses. These verses function as a profound pedagogical tool.
They are explaining the nature of a fully awakened being to a child, but they're really meant to explain it to us, the audience.
She begins by describing his inner qualities, his mind. She calls him a stainless victor without harmful intent, who is beyond thought and utterly pure.
She says he is a wise man who does not adhere to worldly duty and does not entertain mundane thoughts, such as pleasant or unpleasant.
Notice the heavy emphasis on non-duality right away in the mother's initial description.
She is highlighting his total equanimity. She says praise does not delight him and blame does not upset him. He is like a lotus born from the water.
That is a classic Buddhist metaphor. The lotus is rooted in the muck and mud of the swamp, representing the suffering of the world.
But the blossom rises above it and is entirely unstained by the mud. The Buddha lives in the world, interacts with the world, but is entirely unstained by attachment or aversion.
He has abandoned anger and moves freely, she says, like the wind.
But then the poetry shifts. She moves from his inner qualities to an incredibly detailed, almost overwhelming description of his physical form.
She lists what the tradition calls the 32 major marks of a great man. The verses detail his the crown protrusion on his head, saying it resembles the peak of Mount Meru.
She describes the curled hair between his brows, the ura radiating a light far brighter than a lattice of pure crystal lunar rays.
The imagery she uses is exceptionally vivid. She speaks of his eyes being like blue lotuses, his jaw like a glorious lion's jaw.
His lips are red like the bimba fruit, a bright red gourd found in India. She mentions his long, thin tongue, which can miraculously cover his entire face.
And his webbed fingers, soft as cotton. She details how the soles of his feet are adorned with intricate wheels, hooks, swastikas, and conches.
Right.
Okay, I have to step in here and offer an analogy because I think many modern readers hit this section of a sutra and feel a profound sense of alienation.
It is very common to feel that way.
When I try to visualize these marks webbed fingers, arms that reach past the knees, a tongue that can cover the face, a golden glowing body, it sounds completely alien.
It's of trying to picture a color we have never seen.
Exactly. To a modern ear, this heavy, almost obsessive emphasis on physical, otherworldly characteristics can feel jarring. It feels like it detracts from the profound philosophical teachings we just discussed.
You wonder why it's even in there.
Yeah. Why does the Maha Yejna tradition place such massive importance on describing this physical perfection? Why not just stick to the teachings?
Well, it is a very natural reaction to feel a sense of cognitive dissonance when you first encounter these descriptions. We are conditioned by a purely biological Darwinian view of the human body.
Right, genetics and biology.
To understand these marks, we must step outside that framework entirely. In the Buddhist worldview, the physical form is not a random genetic lottery.
What is it then?
It is a direct, proportional manifestation of a being's accumulated karma.
So his body is literally a physical map of his past actions.
Precisely. The text is telling us that each specific mark corresponds to specific, unimaginably difficult virtues practiced over millions of lifetimes.
Oh, wow. So they aren't just random cool features.
Not at all. For instance, the long tongue is said to be the karmic result of countless lifetimes of speaking only the truth, never lying, never using harsh words.
And the webbed fingers.
The webbed fingers represent how he has gathered beings together with the four means of attraction: generosity, pleasant speech, purposeful behavior, and consistency.
So we shouldn't picture a strange mutated human. We should picture a being whose physical form is entirely constructed out of pure virtue.
Yes. The perfection of the physical body mirrors the absolute perfection of the mind. Furthermore, this specific form, which the tradition calls the rupakaya, or form body, is understood as an outpouring of immense compassion.
Meaning he doesn't actually need to look like that for himself.
Exactly. The Buddha doesn't need a physical body at all. He manifests this form deliberately. It's designed to be majestic, awe-inspiring, and undeniably extraordinary, precisely to capture the attention of beings who are drowning in mundane suffering.
It is a form meant to break through our ordinary, dull perceptions. It stops you in your tracks, just as it stopped Ratnadatta.
And the mother doesn't just describe his visual appearance. She describes the sound of his voice.
She says his speech satisfies beings like the sweet chirp of a sparrow, but is more beautiful and resonant than a peacock, a swan, a flute, or the deep rumble of thunder.
She says his speech possesses perfect poetic embellishments. The tradition states that the voice of a Buddha has 60 specific qualities.
60 qualities? That's incredibly specific.
It is. It is perfectly pitched to the capacity of the listener. The mother notes, beings with different inclinations and different interpretations have faith in what he says and become exceedingly happy.
Because his communication is flawless, it arises from a mind entirely free of self-interest.
He isn't trying to win an argument or sound smart or defend his ego. When there is no ego behind the vocal cords, the sound that emerges is perfectly attuned to the needs of the universe.
Hearing this phenomenal description, recognizing the sheer astronomical rarity of such a being, the 3-year-old Ratnadatta is utterly overcome.
He feels a desperate, urgent need to make a physical connection with the Buddha.
He says to his mother, "Put me in the window so I can see the thus gone one." And when his mother holds him up to the window and he looks down and sees the Buddha approaching their door, the child thinks to himself,
"Since it is difficult to meet such an extraordinary being, even in a trillion eons, I should jump down from this house."
It is a breathtaking narrative moment, a literal physical leap of faith.
It represents the total abandonment of self-preservation in the face of ultimate truth.
He grabs his favorite toy, which the text tells us happens to be a magnificent golden lotus with 100,000 petals, and he just throws himself out of the high window.
Now, of course, the Buddha, possessing ultimate compassion and miraculous power, does not let the child plummet to the street and die. He halts Ratnadatta in midair.
So hold this image in your mind. You have a 3-year-old boy hovering magically in midair above the bustling streets of Vaishali, looking directly into the face of the Buddha.
And while hovering there, suspended between heaven and earth, Ratnadatta tosses his golden lotus toy toward the Buddha as an offering.
The Buddha then performs another subtle miracle. He transforms that falling toy into a massive jeweled lotus parasol that hovers perfectly in the sky, providing shade above the Buddha's own head.
The exchange of miracles is visually beautiful, but it is the verses that Ratnadatta speaks while making this offering that truly signal the philosophical tectonic shift of this text.
Up until this exact moment, we have seen devotion, we have seen poetry, and we have seen miracles.
Now, suspended in the air, this child ushers us into the realm of radical, uncompromising Mahayana philosophy.
Ratnadatta speaks these verses of offering, and they are shocking in their clarity. They represent a total rejection of normal religious transactionalism.
He says, "I offer this lotus to the Buddha, seeking nothing in return. I seek supreme awakening to eliminate all goals."
Let me repeat that because it is so counterintuitive. To eliminate all goals.
We really have to unpack that deeply. Think about how we normally function. In traditional merit-making, even within standard Buddhist practice, there is often an underlying transactional economy at play.
Right, like I give this food to the monk, or I offer this flower at the altar, or I meditate for 30 minutes to generate good karma.
I do it to ensure a better rebirth, or to attain my own personal liberation, or even just to have a more peaceful Tuesday.
There is a subject, me giving an object, the flower or the time, to a recipient, the Buddha, for a specific result. I am making a deposit in the spiritual bank.
But Radhadatta is essentially hacking the bank. He is burning the currency, the bank, and the depositor all at once.
He explicitly subverts the entire transaction. He continues, "Since in unborn awakening there is nothing to gain or lose and nothing to accept or reject, I offer this flower."
He is speaking strictly from the ultimate viewpoint of emptiness. If reality at its core is unborn meaning phenomena do not have any inherent, independent, solid existence, then the conceptual categories of gaining merit or losing defilements are ultimately illusory.
They are useful fictions for beginners, but they are not the ultimate truth.
Precisely. He delivers this devastating line to the assembly. He says the conception of value that childish beings construct is pointless.
He says, "I make this offering to the supreme human being so that I may eliminate all conceptual thought. I do not offer this flower so that a result will ripen for me.
I offer this lotus blossom to eliminate all existent things."
To eliminate all existent things. Now, he does not mean he wants to destroy the physical world with a laser beam, right?
No, not at all. He means eliminating the mental reification of things as solid, separate, and inherently existent. He is completely deconstructing the very act he is currently performing.
He is giving a gift while simultaneously using the fire of non-dual awareness to dissolve the giver, the gift, and the recipient.
Yes, he is resting the pure, empty action of generosity without any clinging to a story about it.
And as you can imagine, this display of profound, non-dual, anti-transactional offering provokes a massive reaction from the traditional monastic establishment watching this unfold from the street.
They have dedicated their lives to accumulating merit and avoiding non-virtue. This sets up the central philosophical debate of the teaching.
We now see the revered elders step forward to correct this child. First up is Venerable Moggallana.
Moggallana is one of the Buddha's two chief disciples. He is immensely respected, the absolute authority on monastic discipline, and renowned throughout the ancient world for his own miraculous powers.
He represents the pinnacle of the traditional, disciplined, step-by-step path.
He hears this toddler hovering in the air, saying he seeks nothing, that value is pointless, and that he wants to eliminate all goals. Moggallana challenges the boy.
He says, "Although you make this offering out of faith in such a teacher, your understanding is mistaken. How, then, will you become a Buddha?"
And you have to sympathize with Moggallana here. His question is entirely logical from a conventional standpoint.
If you don't believe in cause and effect, if you refuse to set a goal, if you claim that spiritual value itself is pointless, how can you possibly traverse the path to Buddhahood?
Right. You need a destination to walk a path. You need a goal.
This friction brings us to a crucial concept in this text. Perhaps the most important glossary term for you, our listener, to deeply understand today. The term is alambana, which is translated into English as apprehending.
Yes, apprehending.
What exactly is the mechanism of apprehending in this context?
Apprehending, or alambana, is considered the core cognitive error, the original glitch in human consciousness, according to Mahayana philosophy.
How so?
It refers to the continuous unconscious mental activity of grasping at a subject, an object, and the relationship between them as if they possessed inherent, independent, solid reality.
Let's try to ground that with an analogy. Is apprehending like when you go to a movie theater and you get so sucked into the drama on the screen that you start crying?
Yes, your heart is racing, you are terrified for the main character.
Completely forgetting that you are just sitting in a dark room watching light hit a flat screen. You are apprehending the movie as solid reality.
That is an excellent baseline analogy. You are taking a projection and treating it as an inherently existent truth. But let's take that analogy a step further into how we do this with our own identities and our spiritual lives.
Okay, how does that work?
When you sit down to meditate and you have a moment of peace, your mind immediately generates the thought, "I am meditating well. I am a good spiritual practitioner."
Ah, I see.
You have just apprehended.
Yeah.
You have taken the fluid, empty experience of peace, turned it into a solid object called good meditation, and created a solid subject called me, the good meditator.
You have solidified a dualism.
Exactly. Radhadatta is saying that as long as you are apprehending, you are trapped, no matter how holy the objects you are apprehending might be.
So Radhadatta turns from the Buddha to this senior revered monk, and he delivers an absolute intellectual roasting.
He really does.
He says, "All these entities are unborn. Conditioned things are hollow and void. How could such phenomena have any substance?" And then he gets incredibly personal.
He says, "You wear saffron monastic robes and grasp at the state of a worthy one, but aren't consciousness and its domain simply empty?"
It is a breathtaking confrontation. He is accusing Maudgalyana, a senior arhat who is worshipped by thousands, of still being caught in the trap of apprehending.
He is saying, you think your physical robes make you holy. You think your psychological state of being an arhat is a real, solid, permanent achievement. You've just replaced worldly grasping with spiritual grasping.
He pushes the knife even further, asking Maudgalyana, do you still engage in apprehending? Can someone who thinks as you do even purify a gift?
That last line is a devastating critique of the monastic system. The purity of an offering made by a layperson to a monk is traditionally dependent on the monk's purity of mind.
So Ratnadatta implies that because Maudgalyana still conceptualizes reality in dualistic terms, still sees himself as a solid receiver getting a solid gift, his mind is fundamentally impure.
And thus he cannot properly receive or bless an offering.
Okay, I have to jump in here and play devil's advocate because there is a major apparent contradiction here.
I know exactly where you're going with this.
If the Buddha himself taught the foundational path, if the Buddha spent decades teaching the aggregates, the Noble Eightfold Path, the strict difference between ignorance and enlightenment, and the law of karma, why is this toddler telling a senior monk that making these exact distinctions makes him a childish being?
It seems like a massive contradiction.
Is the sutra directly contradicting the historical Buddha?
It is the vital question that has driven centuries of Buddhist debate. What we are witnessing here is the classic Mahayana critique of the foundational theory of phenomena, specifically the Abhidharma.
Right. To understand this, think of Abhidharma like spiritual atomic theory.
Exactly. In the foundational path, practitioners analyze reality by breaking it down into smaller and smaller components, called dharmas.
They believe that while a chariot is just a concept, the individual parts making up the chariot are real. They were looking for the ultimate, solid building blocks of the universe, both mental and physical.
So they were trying to find the bedrock of reality. And the foundational teachings, often referred to as the hearer vehicle, were taught by the Buddha using this framework as a skillful means.
They are provisional truths.
Yes. They are necessary to help coarse, confused beings stop acting harmfully, begin calming their minds, and detach from gross worldly pleasures. You have to use the illusion of a ladder to get people to climb out of a burning house.
But once you are out of the burning house and standing in the open air...
Once you are out, you have to realize the ladder was also made of wood and will eventually burn too. You have to let it go.
Ratnadatta is arguing from the standpoint of ultimate truth, or emptiness. He's saying that taking provisional concepts like arising, cessation, karma, or even nirvana as ultimately real building blocks is a profound trap.
If you grasp at nirvana as a solid thing to be acquired, you are still operating with an egoic acquiring mind. The true nature of phenomena, which is called suchness, is entirely beyond all dualistic constructs.
There are no solid atomic building blocks. It is empty all the way down.
Ratnadatta makes this explicit. He says right to Maudgalyana's face, the world is a fake, deceptive, and illusory appearance that tricks childish beings.
And when Maudgalyana tries to defend himself using logic, saying, wait, if the world is fake, then this teaching you're giving me is also fake, so why even teach it?
Ratnadatta counters that ultimate phenomena cannot be demonstrated, attained, or meditated upon through logic. They can only be realized through non-conceptual wisdom.
Ultimately, Maudgalyana falls completely silent. The text makes a point of telling us he remains totally silent.
The silence of Maudgalyana is deafening. It signifies the complete inability of conventional dualistic logic to counter the ultimate lived truth of emptiness.
Seeing Maudgalyana silenced by a three-year-old, another heavy hitter from the assembly realizes he must step forward to test the boy.
This is Venerable Shiriputra. If Maudgalyana is the master of miracles, Shiriputra is famously known as the disciple foremost in wisdom and intellect.
He tries a different, sharper angle. He asks the Buddha how long this child has been practicing, and then turns to Ratnadatta and asks a very direct, piercing question.
He says, if you are so wise, why have you not become a complete Buddha who has manifested unsurpassed and perfect awakening?
Shiriputra is brilliant here. He is using the child's own absolute logic against him.
He is essentially saying, if you truly understand that there are no goals and no path, then why are you still manifesting as a three-year-old boy in the cycle of samsara? Why haven't you attained the final goal and vanished into nirvana?
Ratnadatta's response is one of the most famous, mind-bending, and liberating lines in the entire sutra. He looks at Shariputra and says, "The reason I do not become a complete manifest Buddha is that I do not apprehend unsurpassed and perfect awakening."
We need to sit with the gravity of that idea for a moment. He's not saying he lacks the merit, or that he hasn't meditated enough, or that he is lazy.
He is saying the very reason he doesn't achieve awakening is because he actively refuses to turn awakening into an object that can be apprehended or captured.
He goes on to brutally dismantle the entire concept of getting enlightened. He states, "Childish beings obtain and attain. A childish being who attains nirvana is thoroughly attached to samsara."
Such conceited thinking is Mara's trap.
Mara being the mythological personification of delusion, death, and obstacles. Ratnadatta is pointing out a terrifying paradox for anyone on a spiritual path.
That striving for liberation can organically become the very thing preventing it.
Exactly.
How does that work? How can trying to be free trap you?
Because the very mechanism of striving intrinsically implies an ego. It implies a solid self that is currently in a bad place, trying desperately to attain a good place called liberation.
It is the ultimate form of spiritual materialism.
You are taking the exact same grasping software that used to desire money, status, or a nicer house, and you were just porting it over to desire enlightenment.
The object of desire has changed, but the underlying mechanism of tight, anxious grasping remains identical. And as long as you are grasping, you are reinforcing the ego.
He says, "Someone who thinks I have attained has not attained anything at all. They will proceed to their next birth and start all over again in ignorance."
It is a devastating critique of spiritual pride.
It is. And it extends to how they view the mechanics of practice itself. Ratnadatta critiques those who treat insight or prajna as a seed.
Right, he says, they apprehend insight and have a deluded notion of it as a seed. What does he mean by that agricultural metaphor?
In the foundational teachings, we constantly use agricultural metaphors. We tell people, plant the seed of good deeds, water it with meditation, and eventually in the future, it will grow into the fruit of enlightenment.
It is a linear cause and effect model.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But Ratnadatta argues that true reality, ultimate suchness, is unconditioned. It is not produced by causes. You cannot grow emptiness.
Because emptiness is already the fundamental nature of everything right now.
Treating insight as a seed that produces an effect in the future means you are still stuck believing in the conditioned world of linear time.
He summarizes this profound realization with a beautiful paradoxical phrase. He says, "In the view taught by the victor, with pure vision, there is no viewing. That is why those who have insight do not grasp at the thought, 'I am free.'"
Because the moment you formulate the thought, "I am free,"
yeah,
you have instantly resurrected the I that you believe is separate from everything else.
True freedom is the absence of the one who needs to be free.
So Ratnadatta has completely dismantled the logic of the foundational path. He has silenced the two greatest arhats. He's proven that you cannot logic your way to emptiness and you cannot strive your way to peace.
But that creates a massive, glaring pedagogical problem. If you cannot use logic, if you cannot give people goals, and if any attempt to practice just reinforces the ego.
How on earth does a teacher actually instruct a beginner?
Exactly. You can't just stare at them in silence, which is exactly the paradox that the next interlocutor realizes he has to address. The Bodhisattva Manjushri steps forward.
This is a crucial shift in the dialogue. Manjushri is the embodiment of transcendent wisdom in the Mahayana tradition. He is not approaching Ratnadatta defensively from a place of foundational dualism like the arhats did.
He completely agrees with Ratnadatta's premise, but he is probing the practical application.
He is asking how this profound, non-dual truth can actually be transmitted to someone still trapped in delusion.
Manjushri asks Ratnadatta a highly practical question. He says, "How should beginner bodhisattvas be given instructions on this? How should they be taught about awakening, since it is fundamentally devoid of verbal designations?"
It is the ultimate teacher's dilemma. If the ultimate truth cannot be apprehended, cannot be attained, and cannot even be spoken of without instantly falsifying it by turning it into a concept, what do you tell the suffering beginner who just walked in the door asking for help?
Ratnadatta's answer contains the most shocking, counterintuitive, and frankly explosive instructions of the entire text. Uh-huh. Listen carefully to what this enlightened child tells the embodiment of wisdom to teach beginners.
It really is wild.
He says, one should say the following: "Do not abandon desire. Do not get rid of anger. Do not clear away delusion. Do not rise above the body. practice non-virtue, do not vanquish views, do not remove fetters, grasp at the aggregates, abandon virtue, do not contemplate the Buddha, do not think about the Dharma, do not make offerings to the Sangha, do not take up the trainings, do not strive to pacify existence, do not cross over the river.
When you hear that list for the first time, it sounds like absolute madness.
It sounds like pure heresy. It is the exact literal opposite of everything a Buddhist or any religious person is supposed to do.
It sounds like a psychological shock tactic. I liken it to a Zen koan, perhaps a paradoxical intervention in modern psychotherapy.
It feels deliberately designed to completely break the mind's normal dualistic functioning.
Right.
Because if you tell a typical beginner you must seek virtue and abandon anger, their ego will immediately just build a new shiny identity around being the virtuous person.
They will repress their anger, build a shadow self, look down on non-virtuous people, and grasp tightly at their own contrived goodness.
That is a very accurate psychological reading. This is a total inversion of foundational morality. But if you look at the underlying mechanics, it is deeply, rigorously consistent with the doctrine of emptiness.
Ratnadatta explains why he gives this terrifying advice. He says the realm of phenomena is discerned through non-conceptuality.
Which means what, in practice?
It means that trying to forcefully reject one thing, like your own anger, or your worldly desires, and desperately grab onto another thing like peace or nirvana, is pure, unadulterated dualism.
It constantly reinforces the agonizing illusion that there is a bad state you are currently in and a good state you need to escape to.
But in the light of emptiness, samsara and nirvana are fundamentally indistinct. They are both empty of inherent reality. If you truly deeply understand the emptiness of your anger, you don't need to wage war against it or get rid of it.
You just see it arise and vanish like a cloud in the sky. It has no solid substance to harm you.
Exactly. By telling the beginner not to abandon anger, he is forcing them to stop fighting reality and start looking at its empty nature.
Ratnadatta concludes this shocking pedagogical advice by saying, if someone receives the instruction that understanding the nature of phenomena in this way is awakening, and if they are not afraid, scared, or frightened by it, then that person is a bodhisattva who will truly never regress.
The fear he mentions there is the visceral terror of ego death. When you strip away the comforting ladder of moral progression, the clear rules of what makes you a good person, the ego panics.
It wants rules. It wants a hierarchy. It wants to contemplate the Buddha as an external savior who will reward it for being good.
If you hear that you must abandon even that holy grasping, and you do not panic, you have finally glimpsed the true unconditioned path.
But as we see in the very next section of the sutra, not everyone in the assembly is ready for such an explosive, non-dual truth. The text takes a visceral, sudden, and seemingly fatal turn.
We must always remember the power of these teachings. In this cosmological worldview, they are not merely interesting academic concepts to be debated in a seminar. They are ontological forces that shatter worldviews and restructure subtle anatomy.
The sutra tells us that 8 monks in the assembly, who maintained the view of apprehending meaning, they were still deeply attached to the idea of solid reality and a solid self-refuse to follow this Dharma teaching.
They hear Ratnadatta say, abandon virtue, and their minds violently reject it. And the physical reaction is intense.
The text says, they all vomited warm blood and died. And after they died, they were reborn in the great wailing hell.
It is a profoundly shocking narrative development. To our modern sensibilities, it seems unbelievably harsh, almost punitive.
We naturally ask, why would hearing a teaching of ultimate compassion and liberation result in agonizing death and hellfire?
We aren't the only ones horrified. Manjushri is similarly alarmed. He immediately turns to the Buddha and voices deep concern, pointing out the immense apparent harm this teaching just caused these 8 monks.
But the Buddha's response provides a stunning revelation about the cosmic timescale and the hidden mechanics of karma. The Buddha corrects Manjushri. He tells him not to view this event through a limited worldly lens.
The Buddha says, if these monks had not heard this Dharma teaching, they would not have secured higher births for millions of eons, let alone meeting and serving any Buddhas.
Since they just listened to this Dharma teaching with doubt, they are right now dying and transmigrating from the great wailing hell and being reborn among the gods in the heaven of joy.
Let us unpack the mechanics of what the Buddha is revealing here. The mind and the subtle body, the energetic channels of the physical form, are deeply linked.
The ego, with its rigid grasping at reality, is literally a knot in that subtle body.
When the sword of non-dual wisdom slices through that knot too quickly, and the ego forcefully resists it, the energetic recoil is so violent that the physical body cannot contain it. It ruptures.
That is why they vomit blood and die. Hearing the teaching of profound emptiness caused severe cognitive dissonance, yes, but it also forcefully planted an indestructible seed of truth in their consciousness.
So their brief stint in the great wailing hell isn't a punishment from a wrathful god.
Not at all. It is a rapid, intense burning off of their previous heavy karma of rigid, dualistic grasping. The friction of their resistance burned them up.
But because that ultimate seed of the Dharam was planted in their minds, the moment the heavy karma is exhausted, that seed sprouts, and they immediately transmigrate to a heaven realm.
And the Buddha's prophecy for them continues. He says they will serve billions of Buddhas, become universal monarchs, and in a later eon, they will all become complete Buddhas named Vimalaprabhasa.
The Buddha makes a massive definitive statement here about the sheer uncompromising power of the non-dual view. He says that listening to this profound teaching of emptiness, even if you react with doubt, fear, and rejection, generates infinitely greater merit than a bodhisattva practicing the six perfections.
Generosity, discipline, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom.
Yes, practicing those for 100,000 eons if they're still doing it with a subtle mind of grasping.
That is a staggering calculus. 100,000 eons of perfect, flawless moral behavior, if performed with a grasping, self-congratulatory ego, is ultimately worth less than a single moment of hearing about emptiness, even if it terrifies you.
It shows that the Dharma operates on a level far beyond conventional morality.
It emphasizes that the ultimate cure for the disease of suffering is not just good behavior or symptom management. It is the total eradication of the root cause, which is ignorance.
The medicine of emptiness is so potent, so fundamentally curative, that even a rejected dose initiates the healing crisis that leads to final awakening.
Having established the unimaginable, reality-altering power of this non-dual view, the sutra moves toward its conclusion. But it doesn't end with more abstract philosophy.
It ends with a practical, beautiful, tangible demonstration of what this non-dual awareness looks like in action. It closes with the inexhaustible feast.
Philosophy in the Mahayana tradition must always, eventually, ground itself back in compassionate action in the world. Ratnadatta has deconstructed the entire spiritual path. He has dissolved the giver, the gift, and the goal.
So now the question is, how does such a being actually operate in the physical world?
He operates with infinite unconditioned generosity. Ratnadatta turns back to his mother in the house and asks for some food to offer the Buddha and his massive retinue.
She goes to the kitchen and fills a single metal bowl with delicious food. Ratnadatta takes this one, single bowl, and makes what is known in the tradition as a truth declaration.
He says, since it is true that all phenomena are inexhaustible, may the food in this metal bowl not diminish until the entire saga of monks has been satisfied.
Notice his phrasing. He doesn't pray to a deity to magically multiply the food. He relies on the truth of emptiness itself. He offers the food first to the Buddha and then to the entire assembly.
And he explicitly challenges them while he does it. He asks them to accept the food without purifying it with their body or mind and without attempting to generate merit from the meal.
He is essentially commanding them to eat with the exact same non-dual awareness he has been teaching. Eat without an ego eating, he is saying.
And the miracle occurs. That single bowl of food feeds the entire monastic assembly of thousands. But the abundance doesn't stop there.
The text says the child Ratnadatta then fed the entire population of the city of Vaishali with delicious food from that exact same bowl. And even then, the alms did not run out.
It is a stunning poetic metaphor for the nature of reality. When you stop trying to defensively quantify, possess, and grasp at reality, when you realize that the hard boundaries we place around mine and yours, enough and empty, are illusory mental constructs, the natural abundance of reality is revealed to be infinite.
Emptiness is not a dark, terrifying void. It is a profound, inexhaustible potential from which all compassion flows.
Following this beautiful miracle, the Buddha formalizes the teachings the toddler has given. He codifies them for the assembly so they can be remembered and practiced. He outlines the five specific ways a bodhisattva purifies a gift.
These five purifications are a perfect, concise summary of non-apprehending and daily action. First, not apprehending a body, meaning you don't obsess over the physical act.
Second, not apprehending a mind, you don't cling to the intention. Third, having no attachment to the gift itself.
Fourth, not desiring any ripening or karmic reward for yourself. And fifth, desiring no ripening even for the recipients. It is pure, unadulterated giving that leaves no karmic trace.
And the Buddha adds the four things a bodhisattva must always manifest: the meditative concentration on emptiness, recollecting the Buddha, great compassion, and the ripening of one's own karma.
That specific combination is the beating heart of the Mahayana path. The concentration on emptiness ensures you don't grasp or build an ego.
But the great compassion ensures you don't retreat into a cold, nihilistic void. It forces you to engage warmly and endlessly with the suffering world.
Finally, the sutra closes with the ultimate prophecy. The Buddha addresses Manjushri and declares that in 30 eons, this incredible three-year-old toddler, Ratnadatta, will become a complete Buddha himself.
He will be known as the Buddha Amokabalakirti. And as is traditional, Manjushri asks the Buddha for the name of the teaching they have just witnessed, so it may be preserved.
The Buddha gives two names. He says it should be remembered as teaching the practice of a bodhisattva, which is descriptive. Mm-hmm. But then he offers a second, breathtakingly beautiful title, a being born from reality.
A being born from reality. What a profound title. It suggests that Ratnadatta's immense wisdom doesn't come from studying books or following rules or climbing a conceptual ladder.
It emerges spontaneously from a direct, unmediated, naked connection with the ultimate nature of things.
Indeed. And it implies a promise to us. It implies that when we finally find the courage to drop our conceptual frameworks and stop apprehending the world, we too can be reborn from that same underlying, inexhaustible reality.
So we have spent this time navigating deep ancient cosmology, lethal philosophical paradoxes, and floating toddlers. What does this all mean for you, the listener, right now in your daily life?
How do you take a reality-fracturing philosophy like non-apprehending and apply it when you have to go to work, pay bills, and navigate relationships? It might seem impossible to live without grasping at subjects and objects.
It is a profound, lifelong challenge. But living without apprehending doesn't mean we stop functioning. It doesn't mean we walk out into traffic because we think cars are empty of inherent existence.
Emptiness doesn't negate conventional reality. It frees us within it. It means we engage fully, we love deeply, we act with great compassion and generosity, but we radically release our tight, anxious grip on the outcomes.
Think about how this applies to our modern identities. We can let go of our desperate need to construct a self-image as a good person, a successful person, or a spiritual person.
We can let go of our harsh, separating judgments of others who we feel are less evolved than us. If we take Ratnadatta's teachings to heart, it offers the ultimate lasting freedom from burnout and spiritual materialism.
We can give the gift, we can do the difficult work, and then we can drop it entirely, seeking no applause and no reward. We can just be the open space where compassion happens.
We learn to operate skillfully in the world, utilizing conventions and language, but without being deceived by them. We begin to recognize the fluid, dreamlike nature of our struggles, our achievements, and even our most cherished spiritual paths.
We stop trying to climb a ladder that isn't there.
I want to leave you with a final thought, a practical meditation to carry with you after this scholarly lecture concludes. Take a moment right now and think of a goal you are striving for.
It could be career-driven, it could be a relationship goal, or it could be deeply spiritual. Maybe you are striving for peace of mind or hoping to finally achieve some noble insight that will fix your anxiety.
Bring that goal to mind and carefully notice the tension, the subtle or perhaps overwhelming anxiety, the tight grasping wrapped around your desire for that goal.
What if the very tightness with which you are holding that goal is the only thing keeping it separate from you?
What would happen if, like the three-year-old Ratnadatta jumping from the top floor window of his house, you simply let go of the result?
What if you dropped the heavy conceptual weight of what you are desperately trying to attain and allowed yourself to simply rest in the inexhaustible, unconditioned reality of right now?
It is a question that requires immense courage to answer, but it is the only question that leads to true freedom. Thank you for joining us for this profound exploration of the 84,000 translations.
May your engagement with these ancient disruptive texts bring sudden clarity and boundless spaciousness to your own path.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodhiarchive.org. Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.